What we were going to do is we were going to start off with a little group presentation from last week and on that theme of separation of God's chosen. And these were the five groups from last week where we had our discussion. And so I think what we'll do is when the pizzas get here, we'll have someone from each of these groups kind of tell the rest of us what they discussed. And while that's happening, that person's group that we're discussing will go back and get their breakfast pizzas. So then we'll go on to the next group. That group will have a presenter. And while that group presenter is presenting, that group will go back and get their breakfast pizzas. So that way it'll be a little more organized. So I know that Adam was in a group on... you know what? This is an old slide. This is a wrong slide. Huh. All right, well, it's close enough. Well, it's not, actually. Okay, school and work was one group. And food and drink was one group. Time was one group. Family and friends was one group. And Adam was in signs and symbols. So... Adam, if you could speak on signs and symbols for us later. And who was in school and work? Who's here? I think Steve was in school and work. No? Oh, actually, Scott was in school and work. Would you be willing to speak to us, Scott, on that issue and kind of the discussion you guys had last week? Yeah? All right, great. Thanks, Scott. Oh, the pizza's here. You know what? Forget that. Oh, wait, no. Let's do that, but let's do it now. All right, great. Scott, you're up. Scott Wass, everyone, one of our young men in the church.
So I'm going to try and remember what we talked about last week. So we had school and work. I think some of the few main points that John Poulin and I came away with for school especially is... making sure you hang out with the right friend groups, because that can really impact you, because who you hang out with is who you're going to be, because they can rub off on you. So John Poulin and I, we were discussing, and we figured one of the main problems is friend groups at school. Hanging out with the right friend group can make a big impact on your studies, your relationships, your... spiritual growth. So just hanging out with the right friend groups is key. And then another thing was doing the right thing. There may be school parties, like there usually are, college parties, just not getting involved in that, keeping your head about you, being in the scripture weekly. That was another one. And just praying to God constantly to keep your eyes in the right direction and not go astray, so to say.
Thank you, Scott. All right, Adam.
Yeah, so in the context of separation, our group briefly discussed several things regarding to signs and symbols. And at first we had some discussion like, what is that even referring to? But the things that we first came up with is the idea that signs and symbols are really a representation of something that a group of people believes in, accepts, or take part of. So with that in mind, we talked about specifically some cultural things, such as specific even bumper stickers that people put on, something that they stand for or identify with. We talked about specific flags that are multiple colors, things like that. So obviously that comes in with separation. And then Eric joined our group, and then we started talking about baptism and Old Testament circumcision and things like that. So those are some biblical examples of signs and symbols.
And I talked with someone after, an obvious cultural sign and symbol of a form of separation that he mentioned that I didn't even think of. Right? What does that mean? So that means I'm separated, right? So in a sense. All right, who had family and friends? I think that was back here. Do you remember? Who was in family and friends? No? Yeah? Oh, great.
Can't believe I'm the only one that was in the group. Family and friends. We talked about gatherings of, and there's a wide separation of beliefs in family, but also in friends, as far as drinking, of course, and what the party or the gathering is centered around, and separation from that. And you may attend the gathering, but it doesn't mean you have to participate in what's going on, as far as if it's alcohol related or not. But and what, not necessarily you don't go, but you just probably won't be invited the next time, is probably what happens over time. But then we also went into the thought of, if we are going to be separated, is that the same as isolated? And if we're totally separated, who's going to be a missionary? Who's going to be the example to the person that's not saved or whatever? So I would encourage Eric or this whole area to talk more about separation versus isolation. And there's a limit to the separation, or we're not going to be participants in the world or examples in the world. So we didn't really come up with any conclusions, but more of a question of that part.
That's a really great point. Thanks. And we have two different words, right? We have separation and we also have isolation. And they really do have different meanings. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. There's two Hebrew words that have different meanings as well. It makes a difference in how you understand it. So food and drink, that was the last group. Who was in food and drink? It's a nice segue that we had into drink. Okay, I'll speak to this one, I guess. So there are ways that we can attend gatherings and separate from the behavior happening there if we think that, you know, that's appropriate. And I think alcohol intoxication, obviously, we would all agree here, the Bible's clear that that's a sinful activity and not something that, as chosen by God, that we should be participating in. There might come a time when, if we separate from that activity, we aren't invited. So, and is that a good thing? You know, it's a hard thing. There's a range of separation. There's extremes on both ends, and it's not just an issue for us. It was an issue for the Jewish people living at Jesus' time in his culture as well. And we've talked about that a little bit already several times. In a way, food and drink restrictions for the Jewish people, as explained in the Torah and required by the Torah, was connected with separation because it facilitated it. That's one way of viewing the dietary restrictions, for example. They're really fairly simple. Not just the instructions against intoxication, but the food laws against eating pork for those who are land-based farming communities, raising farm animals and eating of those animals. All the rest of the world came to domesticate and eat pork, except for the Jewish people, because of the Torah. There's nothing inherently, biologically or medically speaking, unhealthy about eating pork, but it was something that God designated as being not food. So what effect does that have if you're living your life in a community of mixed people? The Israelites come into the promised land. They have their communities, but there's also nearby communities and there's mixed communities. And if that community is going to have a big festival and they're going to roast a pig and everyone's going to get together and have meat, and remember at these times, the times that we're reading about the Davidic kingdom and the Israelites, meat was not commonly eaten because it was very expensive. So typically someone might eat meat once a week, that if that. So to have a community get a big pig roast going and get all together for meat, that was a big deal. But the Israelites, if they were following Torah, would not participate in that. So the dietary restriction creates separation. Likewise, if you were in a fishing community on the coast and you ate mostly from the sea, the Torah requirements say that you're not to eat any shellfish or invertebrates of any kind. So that eliminates clams, shrimp, lobster, crab, you know, all the shellfish. So if your fishing community is going to have a big, you know, what do they call it? Clam bake. Yeah, get together for a big clam bake. It's the same idea. If you're Israelite following Torah restrictions, you're not going to participate in the clam bake. And that dietary restriction creates a separation by its very nature. So this is probably one of the purposes, I would say perhaps the main purpose of the dietary restrictions of the Torah. So God knew what was best for his people at that time living there, when they would come into the promised land. And he repeatedly instructed them to separate themselves from the Canaanites and the other non-Israelite people. And he provided tools to facilitate that separation process. So we'll think about that some more as we go through our study. 1 Chronicles 10, Shaul sinned against Yahweh. As we go through, I want to invite feedback from all of you. I've purposefully included Hebrew spellings and transliterations and name pronunciations and words and all of this to add interest and add depth to our understanding, to the learning process. I think that in some people, at least, it could help you to be engaged, because you're taken out of this mindset of, I've heard all this before. That's one advantage. But there also may be a disadvantage in that when I say a name like Shaul is Saul, if that's distracting to you, to use a Hebrew pronunciation, right? I don't want the Hebrew to be a distraction so you actually don't get any meaningful points out of the lessons. So I'm just opening that up to feedback. I'd like to receive that feedback from you. If you do think, as we go through the lessons, if you think that there's too much Hebrew and it's too distracting and you're not getting the points because of it, let me know. Because there's a variable amount of this that can be included or not included. So, 1 Chronicles 10. I'm going to go ahead and read through it. This is from the literal English version. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines followed hard after Shaul and after his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Shaul. The battle went hard against Shaul, and the archers overtook him, and he was distressed by reason of the archers. Then Shaul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and abuse me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was terrified. Therefore Shaul took his sword and fell on it. I'm going to skip down. And the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Shaul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They stripped him and took his head and his armor and sent into the land of the Philistines all around to carry the news to their idols and to their people. They put his armor in the house of their Elohim and fastened his head in the house of Dagon. When all of Yavesh Gilad heard that the Philistines had done what they had done to Shaul, all the valiant men arose and took away the body of Shaul and the bodies of his sons and brought them to Yavesh and buried their bones under the oak in Yavesh and fasted 7 days. Here's the key two verses in the chapter. So Shaul died for his trespass, which he committed against Yahweh. Because of the word of Yahweh, which he did not guard, and also because he asked counsel of a medium to inquire and did not inquire of Yahweh. Therefore he, Yahweh, killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Yishai. So Shaul sinned against Yahweh these ways. First, he did not guard the word of Yahweh. And what does that mean, to guard the word of Yahweh? We kind of come back to this over and over again. As I told you, I believe last week, the week before, the temple service is opened with the Shema and closed with the Shema every day. And the Shema was probably the most popular prayer said on a daily basis among Jewish people living both at the time of Jesus and even today. So a key part of that prayer is, I have given you my, sorry, I just want to get it right. Deuteronomy 6:6. And these words which I command you today shall be on your heart. Where does that come? It comes right after you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your being and all your might. And these words which I command you today shall be on your heart. And what comes next? And you shall diligently teach them to your children. So this is what Shaul did not do. Because he was not doing that, he went into sorcery and witchcraft to try and get answers to the situation he was in. This huge Philistine army coming against him, obviously very anxious about that, wondering what to do. And we have an apparent discrepancy only because of the way the English gets translated from Hebrew in 1 Chronicles compared to the passage in 1 Samuel 28:6. So Samuel 28:6 says, when Shaul asked of Yahweh, Yahweh did not answer him, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. And Chronicles says that he did not inquire of Yahweh. So which was it? Well, there's two Hebrew words here. Sha'al means to ask or beg, and darash means to inquire, carefully seek or investigate a matter. And this is where the discrepancy comes in. So what it's saying, what Chronicles is saying, is that Shaul did not inquire, carefully seek out God's will on this matter. But he did do this when he went and asked the witch for help at Endor. So if Shaul had been putting the law of God into his heart and mind on a daily basis, he would have perhaps known the sinfulness, the degree of sinfulness that he was committing by going and seeking out such a person in witchcraft and sorcery to try and get some answers. But that's the sinful thing that he chose to do, and that's why he's criticized here. So there isn't a contradiction in the verses. It's just a matter of nuance. It's kind of like a little bit like separation. What are we talking about there? Are we talking about isolation or how much separation? You know, there's a nuanced meaning here between these two words. Asking and begging someone versus investigating a matter, inquiring of someone. There's a nuanced difference in those meanings, and that's where we get this. Yeah, there's different ways of looking at that. You can also say that the people chose Saul, but if you remember the story, Saul was chosen by Lot, and that was, in a sense, directed by God, and God agreed with the choice. And there's, right, that's what I mean. And at the end of 1 Samuel 15, it says that both Samuel mourned for Shaul, and Yahweh grieved that he had made Shaul king over Israel. So Yahweh, you know, is he had a role in the choosing of Saul, and he grieved over Saul's disobedience, as he does ours, I'm sure. Let's read Samuel 15 because it really has a lot to teach us, and the meanings and the lessons just jump out at the page. They don't even have to be explained. Before I do that, though, I do want to explain one interesting thing, and that is in verse 23, 15:23, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as vain exertion and teraphim. Because you have rejected the word of Yahweh, he has also rejected you from being king." It's one of the most famous passages in all of the Bible. I just want to explain, in your Bible, probably household gods or idols is the word that's used for teraphim. The Hebrew word is teraphim. What is teraphim? So, interestingly, I'll just read you a description of what teraphim is. And this is from the Targum Pseudo-Jonathan, which is a translation of the Torah into Aramaic that occurred by Holy Land living Jewish rabbis. And probably it was done during the Middle Ages. So this is where we get this information. So, commonly translated into English, household idols, teraphim. According to this document of the Middle Ages, they were made, these idols, okay, this is a specific kind of idol. They were made from the heads of firstborn male humans. The heads were salted and spiced for preservation and odor reduction. It was said that a golden tablet was inscribed with a blessing and placed under the tongue. In 1 Samuel 19, David's wife Michal places a teraphim in their bed to make Shaul's men think it was David. This would seem to agree with this document from the Middle Ages, as the teraphim would have at least resembled a human head. So, I don't know if you remember that story, but Saul's men are chasing after David, and David escapes, like, through the window or something, and his wife puts the teraphim under the sheet and pulls the sheet over it, and then puts some other stuff to make it look like his body's under the sheet. And they attack him there, but he's not there. Anyway, so pretty interesting, right? So now let's read 1 Samuel 15. So Samuel said to Saul, Yahweh sent me to anoint you to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore listen to the voice of the words of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh Sivaot. Sivaot means the leader of the forces, the military forces. In this case, Yahweh Sivaot. Yahweh's military forces are his angelic forces, the angels. And this word is often translated in English as Lord of Hosts. What that means is the leader of the army of God. That's what it literally means. And you guys, some of us have been to Israel, you may have remember hearing the word Sivahagana Lisrael. Do you guys, anybody who's maybe Wayne, Sivahagana Lisrael? Do you remember what that is? So it's the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. So it's the same word. Sivah is the military, the army. So Yahweh Sivaot, this is God's army. God is the leader of that army, and he's leading them into battle. That's what this means. Thus says Yahweh Sevaot, I have marked that which Amalek did to Israel, how he set himself against him in the way when he came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. And this word utterly destroy we talked about last week. It's haram. And it means to destroy by burning everything as a sacrifice to me, to God. So, in other words, unlike common practice in the world at that time among all these ancient nations, you're not going to be taking spoils. There's no benefit, personal benefit to you, no spoils. But everything will be destroyed and burned as a sacrifice to me. This is what haram means. So this is what Saul was to do. So we will skip down then to verse 10. Then the word of Yahweh came to Samuel, saying, it grieves me that I have set up Shaul to be king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commands. Then Samuel was angry, and he cried to Yahweh all night. By the way, this is what a faithful person does when they're in a tight spot, and they've gone and asked God for help, for advice, for wisdom, and they've not heard anything from God. Nothing. Jesus has taught us to persist in our asking. So repent of sin. Go and make amends with your brother. Then bring your sacrifice. Continue knocking at the door. Stay faithful to your God. Don't, when you first ask and you hear nothing, start seeking out witchcraft and sorcery. Okay? So, or anything else that's not of God. Samuel rose early to meet Shaul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, saying, Shaul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal. Samuel came to Shaul and said to him, now this is Saul speaking to Samuel, you are blessed by Yahweh. I have performed the command of Yahweh. Samuel said, "Then what does this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the cattle which I hear, what does this mean?" Saul said, "They brought them from the Amalekites, from the battle, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the cattle to slaughter to Yahweh, your Elohim. We have utterly destroyed the rest." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stay, and I will tell you what Yahweh has said to me last night." And Saul said, "Speak." And Samuel said, "Though you were little in your own sight, were you not made the head of the tribes of Israel? Yahweh anointed you king over Israel. And Yahweh sent you on a journey and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of Yahweh, but took the spoils and did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh?" Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of Yahweh. I have gone the way which Yahweh sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, the Israelite soldiers, people, took of the spoil, the sheep and the cattle, the chief of the devoted things, to slaughter to Yahweh, your Elohim, in Gilgal." Samuel said, "Does Yahweh have as great a delight in ascension offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen is better than the fat of rams." So I'm going to pose an uncomfortable question. How many times have we sinned or planned to sin and thought, "I'll give you twice as much offering at church next week, God, after I do this sin to make up for it"? Or you guys do your own equation. Okay? So I would say that this is a very common equation. Does Yahweh have as great a delight in ascension offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as vain exertion and teraphim. Because you have rejected the word of Yahweh, he has also rejected you from being king. Saul said to Samuel, now I'm going to go through a point-by-point explanation, okay, for how not to repent. Because it's not repenting what Saul's doing here, okay? Number one, "I have sinned. This is good. He's on the right track." Okay, that's number one. You have to admit to God that you sinned. "I have transgressed the command of Yahweh." That's good too. "I knew it was sinful and I did it. It was intentional and I'm sorry, God." Now the excuses come. "Because I feared the people and I obeyed their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin." So that's good, asking forgiveness. This is very good, important. And then, what does he say next to Samuel? "Turn again with me that I may bow down to Yahweh." What he means by that is, come with me before the people so I can bow down to Yahweh, and your presence with me in that public display will be confirmation that I'm good with God, you're good with me, we're all good. Okay? Yes, I sinned. Yes, I knew what I was doing and I did it anyway. But excuse, 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 excuse. Please forgive me. Let's move on. Has anyone here ever apologize that way? Has anyone here ever received an apology like that? I'm sorry, what I did was wrong. Excuse, excuse, excuse. Please forgive me. Now let's move on. What, you're still upset? I'm sorry. You're not going to forgive me? Why can't we move on? So, just making it real. This is what Saul did. This is why God rejected him. There was not true repentance here. And that's why God's heart was grieved. First Chronicles 11 and 12, verses 1 through 9. David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, or Yerushalayim in Hebrew. And the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, were there. And you remember the story, they mocked David from the walls. You're never going to get in here. But David was able to, in a very ingenious way, get his soldiers into the city. You can walk through the tunnels underneath some of the natural caverns underneath the city of Jerusalem today on tours and actually follow the path that David's men used from the Gishon Spring to get up into the city. It's pretty cool. Verse 9, then we have Yahweh Sebaot again. David grew greater and greater, for Yahweh Sebaot was with him. And then we go into the mighty men description. Now these are the chief of the mighty men whom David had, who showed themselves strong with him in his kingdom together with all Israel to make him king according to the word of Yahweh concerning Israel. And then we have in verse 11 and the rest of the chapter and into chapter 12 now, descriptions of who all these mighty men were and some of the interesting things about some of them. We won't go into all that, but it is interesting reading. There is one story, though, that is prominent here and that we'll read. And that is starting in verse 16. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was in Bethlehem at that time. David longed and said, "Oh, that one would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." David, at this time, is being chased around the Judean wilderness by Saul's forces. And he's hiding in a cave with his men. And he says this, "Oh, that one would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Verse 18, "The three broke through the army of the Philistines and drew water out of the well at Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. But David would not drink any of it, but poured it out to Yahweh." By that, the writer means David poured the water onto the ground. And I'll explain why here in verse 19. "Instead, my Elohim," that's God, "my Elohim forbid me that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of these men who have put their beings in jeopardy? For they risked their beings to bring it. Therefore, he would not drink it. The three mighty men did these things." So these three incredibly brave guys who loved David so much to risk their life to do this for him. And I'm sure there was some young testosterone-driven bravado as a part of it too. Let's see if we can do this, right? They sneak into the enemy lines, they draw water from the well, they bring it back to David. But this is the kind of leader that David was. He recognized that these three great guys that he loved had risked their lives to get this water. So he's saying, "This water is like your blood because of the way that you risked your life for it. And therefore, like blood before Yahweh, I'm not going to drink it. I'm going to pour it out into the ground," which is what you're supposed to do with the blood of an animal that you kill in hunting, for example, or in any other type of killing for purposes of eating meat. The blood was never to be eaten according to Torah, but poured into the ground as an offering to God. The blood being the representation of the life of the animal and also representation of the life of a human. So it was very sacred, and to be treated that way, never ingested. And so this is what David is doing. Not only is he showing respect for God and his Torah, he's also showing respect for his men. He's showing his men how much he loves them and appreciates them by doing this. So, the heart of David. And we go in and we have descriptions of the others. There's another interesting point here now toward the end of chapter 11. At least several of David's mighty men were not Israelites. We have Selek, an Ammonite. The Ammonites were Canaanites. We have Uriah the Hittite. We probably remember that name. And then at the end, we have Tithma the Moabite, so from Moab. Now, if we go on to chapter 12, we'll see that David's mighty men, at least some of them, were highly skilled military fighters. Chapter 12, verse 2, they were armed with bows and could use both the right hand and the left in slinging stones and in shooting arrows from the bow. They were of Shaul's relatives from the tribe of Benjamin. And then chapter 12 goes on. 16 says, some of the children of Benjamin and Judah came to the stronghold to David. And it goes on and lists from every one of the 12 tribes, there were men, fighting men who came to join David's rebellion force. Well, this is while King Saul is still king. And what Ezra, the author of Chronicles, is doing here, remember, Ezra wrote this history with a purpose. And this particular way of writing this history and this point of it is to encourage unity in the returning Israelites who are now Jews, right? Returning from captivity in Babylon, repopulating the Holy Land, building the second temple, they all have to work together. And the old jealousies and rivalries and revenges, do you know what I mean? That happened between the tribes. What Ezra's saying here and encouraging and trying to accomplish here is we need to get away from all of that. All of that is in the past and not important anymore. What's important, all of us captives, Babylonian captives returning to Israel now, is that we all work together. And Ezra was successful in this. They did all come together, even though they represented the returning captives. Basically, every tribe was represented. Most were from Judah and Benjamin, but every one of the northern tribes in the returning Israelite captives was also represented in the return. They all worked together, and they all came to be known by the term Jews, which referred really mainly to those of Judah, which is where we get the word, but they all would come to be associated with that word and in unity, work together. And this is, remember, they return about 500 years before Jesus. Now let's talk about one really important mighty man of David, verse 28. And Zadok, a young man, mighty of valor, and of his father's house, 22 captains. You'll notice that this is in a paragraph, verse 26, of the children of Levi, 4,600. So Zadok was one of the of David's military forces that came from the tribe of Levi. Now, the numbers here, 4,600, Ezra is reporting on the number of forces that David would have once he became king. So this is moved on now out of the rebellion point. He's made king. His first capital is Hebron. And from Hebron, many thousands of soldiers from all the tribes would come to him as a unified Israelite king and nation. And Zadok was one of these men, one of the mighty men as well as... And so, who is Zadok? We've talked about it a little bit already, but Zadok was a direct male descendant of Aaron through his son Eleazar and grandson Phinehas. And, of course, a Levite as well, okay? But what's important here is Aaron's sons were designated by God to be the priests, okay? So we're going to talk about what the priests are and what they did, and what they did, particularly at the time of Jesus, which is important. So, we've already talked a little bit about this, but point number two, the Zedekite high priest supported Solomon as David's successor and anointed Solomon king. And this was super important because this was a conflict time as David was very, very old. There were inter-palace intrigues going on, if you remember reading, okay? And the Zedekite priest, as opposed to the other line from Aaron, was the one that supported Solomon. In Babylonian captivity, I've mentioned this before, both Ezekiel, the prophet, and Ezra, the author of Chronicles, they were both Zedekite priests. The high priest for the rebuilt second temple was Yehoshua, or Joshua in our English Bibles. He was a Zedekite priest, and he was specifically chosen by God, according to Ezekiel 44, for then and for the future. As Ezekiel prophesies that in Jesus' reign in the millennial kingdom, there will be another temple and priesthood, and the high priest of that temple in our future in the millennial kingdom will be Zedekite high priest. Zedekite priest was a leader of the Essenes. Remember we talked about that the first lesson? The Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes were the three major religious denominations. Most of the people didn't belong to any of those three, but those were the three major ones. And the Essenes were known for their separation from the rest of Jewish society at the time of Jesus. And the leader of the Essenes was a Zedekite priest. And one of the main beefs that the Essenes had, the reason why they separated, was that the priest, the high priesthood at the time of Jesus, which was not Zedekite, was illegitimate. And this was why they believed it was illegitimate, because they were not of the Zedekite line, and the Zedekite line had been the line chosen by God, according to them, from the time of Solomon, to be the high priest. And the life of a priest in the time of Yeshua, we will start with that next week, because we're out of time now.